Welcome back to The Rose Report. I'm your new host, Madeleine Braggs, joining attorneys Dan Gauthier and Olin Lennitz from Rose Law Group. Here's a message from my predecessor, Wafa Shahid.
Hey guys, just a quick update. I am, unfortunately and fortunately, it's very bittersweet. I am leaving the Rose Report podcast to pursue a graduate degree in Washington, D.C. So I leave you guys in the very capable hands of Madeleine Braggs, our new host. I'm very, very excited that she's going to continue this awesome podcast. I can't wait to see everything you guys do. And it's just been an absolute pleasure to be on the Rose Report. And with that, I'll hand it back to Madeleine. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Wafa. For today's episode, we're joined by senior partner and litigation attorney Logan Elia to honor the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who will forever be remembered as a champion for equal rights. We're also taking a look at what's next for the nation, with only weeks to go before the 2020 presidential election. So, what can we expect to see in the next coming months?
I think we're going to see a big fight about whether or not to confirm a new Supreme Court justice, both before the election and also before the end of Donald Trump's term, especially if he doesn't win re-election.
Yeah, in fact, I think just hours after, I try not to follow Leader McConnell and his statements often, but I did see that just a few hours following her death, he came out and said they will be holding a vote. And you know, we're sort of tallying up, right, as this the days pass, how many GOP senators may or may not follow that lead or break away. But it's going to be interesting to see the push that the left makes and the appeal that the left makes to the right and vice versa on this, I think.
Right. I think at the time of recording, we have Murkowski and Collins have said they've said that the vote should not take place until after. I think one said until after the election and one said after the next president is selected, which I think it's safe to count Romney as part of the dissenting GOP senators. But and I don't think I'm the only one to have made this connection. I think their language, and I think us as attorneys, we often employ the same tactic. Their language is interesting because nothing in either of those statements prevents them from voting on November 3rd. So, and frankly, nothing in those statements prevents them from voting at all. That's just their opinion or their position. And if faced with the vote, I assume they will both still vote. And it, depends which way they vote, I guess. But I think it's just interesting to see the carefully crafted statements that they're issuing, especially considering Collins is unlikely to win re-election based on the trends that the reports that have been coming out of her jurisdiction.
You touch on an interesting point, Olin, and I think that I just want to flesh this out a little bit more because the statements coming out from both Collins and Murkowski, you're right. I think one, I can't remember which one said this, but one of them said that a vote shouldn't happen prior to a new president being elected or re-elected. And then the other said that it shouldn't happen before November 3rd, but neither of them said, should that vote be pushed forward because of the numbers being able to do so, that they wouldn't vote or that they would vote the other way. So I think we have, I've seen a bunch of headlines about tallying up numbers, right, and trying to figure out whether there's the what is it, 49 to, or more than 49. To have a successful vote. And it's not clear that Murkowski and Collins are actually going to vote no, right? It's just that right. It's their opinion that the vote shouldn't happen. And faced with the vote, I mean, that's going to be certainly a tough position for them. And hopefully it doesn't get there, at least in my opinion.
I think the numbers here are particularly interesting because I think the Republicans hold 53 seats in the Senate, and that's counting the seat that's held by Martha McSally. But the interesting thing about McSally is that she wasn't elected, she was appointed. So, and it doesn't look like she's gonna win in the race against Kelly. And my understanding is that if McSally loses the race against Kelly, then unlike other senators who have been elected, she wouldn't actually finish out her term through January. She would be immediately replaced by Kelly as soon as the election results were certified. So if we count Markowski and Collins out, then that gives and we lose, or the Republicans lose McSally, then that leaves exactly 50 votes. So the Republicans need, if they're going to act after the election, need every single Republican other than Markowski and Collins to vote with them in order to get to just a 50-50 split that they could then split with Pence's vote.
Can we talk about the role that filibustering plays into all of this and why it's kind of like circulating around the headlines?
There's certainly a long history of filibuster. It's a procedural rule that allows the minority to act to block a vote because there's a supermajority required to break a filibuster, as I understand it.
Do you think that like filibustering is going to come into play?
I think there's two ways that this could come in play. There's the PR filibuster and then the filibuster for practical relief, right? Because there could be a filibuster to, and there probably will be, to tug at the heartstrings or the, maybe heartstrings isn't the right word, but to try to win over the appeal of the voters for whom the senators represent, right? And that might be one way that a filibuster might do some good. The other way is to actually push the filibuster through and cause some substantive change based on that filibuster. And that's what I'm not sure about.
Currently, it takes, like you said, the supermajority, I believe it takes 60 of the 100 senators to vote for the term cloture. It sounds like closure and it means closure, but it's a French term, I believe. And with when you invoke cloture, you then have only 30 hours of additional debate on any topic. So that's the way to break the filibuster, is to have that supermajority of 60 senators agree, which it doesn't look like that number is reachable currently, assuming everyone votes party lines. It would take a much larger amount of Democratic dissidents than it would Republican dissidents to strike down the vote to reach cloture and to break the filibuster.
I'm thinking back to the Kavanaugh hearings, and my recollection is that the filibuster rule, thanks to rule amendments that have been passed in the past 10 years or so, requires only a simple majority to vote for cloture when the Senate is considering executive branch positions or federal judgeship nominations, which means that the Senate could break a filibuster with only 50 votes plus Pence. So I think that the filibuster is unlikely to be a substantial issue in the appointment of Ginsburg's replacement, if that understanding is accurate.
Okay.
In my short Googling while you were talking, it looks like that is exactly what happened in 2017. It's called the nuclear option, which, yes, allows a simple majority of 51 to approve cloture.
So to me, it seems like it's not very likely that the Democratic Party is going to be successful at stopping the Trump administration from appointing this open seat. Do you guys agree with that? And what strategy do you think that the Democrats could best try to employ to hold off until after the election?
I think by simply the numbers game, you're absolutely right. That there is nothing that the Democrats can do on their own to stop anything from happening. And so from any vote to not reach the Senate floor or any vote to be stricken down on the Senate floor, it would take anywhere from one to four, depending on what's happening, Republicans to join in, or independents, or both, I guess. I guess we're counting the two independents voting alongside the Democrats. to join in voting with the Democrats for anything to go the Democrats' way.
I think that the I agree with what you said, Olin, and I think that taking that for what it is, what the Democrats probably have to do, short of there being some silver bullet that I'm not aware of at this point, you know, a nuclear option version two, for example, the Democrats need to be able to, I don't want to call it, you know, smearing the Republicans, because that's not what I personally want to see. But I think that, you know, looking back to what happened in 2016 after Justice Scalia passed, I anticipate a you know, a huge wave of you know, a huge push from the Democrats to essentially, you know, it's playing the hypocrisy card essentially, right? Because if you remember back to 2016 with Merrick Garland, there was a, we're talking about, what is it? How far are we from the election now? 50 something days? 44 days? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're maybe an eighth of the time as far away from the election as we were when Scalia passed. And so, you know, you have all of these statements that senators made, Republican senators made back in 2016 that I anticipate will come and already have come to light here, and are being used to try to push them to not go back on their quote unquote word. Right. And the question is just whether that's going to work. And I don't know. I honestly don't know whether it's going to work. I have doubts based on you know, what we've seen over the past couple of years here.
If I had to bet, I would bet on the Republicans making an appointment before the election, because I think that they recognize if they lose the election, then any party loyalty probably goes out the window. Right now, I think that the whips are able to control some of the votes of Republican senators based on the idea that Trump is going to be reelected, and that if they vote against him in this election or in this appointment or confirmation hearing, then they're going to have a very difficult time over the course of the next 4 years if they make an enemy of the president. But if Trump is not reelected, then any of that loyalty evaporates. So I can see a great incentive for them to push the nomination through. But I think it's a close call, because they're, as we were just discussing, they're very close to falling below the 50 votes that they need. I mean, they're only holding a three, they only have that by three votes right now. And I can see significant reasons why some of the senators who are up for election in swing districts would be benefited in their own reelection campaigns by pushing or by voting against holding a vote on confirmation before the election. So I don't know which way it'll go. But it's such a big deal that I suspect the party whips are going to be working overtime. And I suspect that the party votes will fall into line. But just a guess.
What do you guys think about the likelihood of there being an attempted vote that at the last minute, for lack of a better way to put it, falls through based on one or more senators essentially dropping off at the last moment? I mean, what is that? I guess two-part question. What's the chance of that happening? Or is this going to be calculated enough where it won't be proposed unless they have the votes for sure, right? And then second, if in fact some GOP senators do drop off at the last moment, what sort of backlash is there then for the Republican Party? What does that mean in the short term?
Yeah, you know, I don't think it's likely at all. And I think that because of, you know, what you were saying, Logan, I agree with you. I don't think that these GOP congressmen and women who are secretly not really liking the idea of another Trump administration for 4 years, I think that they're not willing to risk those hardcore Trump voters in their districts. I think that a Trump voter or somebody who voted for Trump in 2016, there's not a lot to deter them right now as of this week from voting for that administration again. I think the idea of him winning the election after trying to nominate to fill the seat makes them think about the policies way down the line and how if you risk going against that, you can't really convince your own voters back home that your values are the same as theirs, which is actually kind of brings me to another thing I wanted to ask you guys. I'm curious about like how this could maybe split voters who are Republican and who are women. Do you guys think that whether or not they let this nomination go after the election is going to deter or encourage female voters?
No, I honestly don't think, and this is answering your question and the one Logan addressed and Dan as well. I honestly don't think this is going to change how people vote at all. I think it's pretty clear, especially most recently, but in the last, you know, since I've been remotely understanding of politics and the way it works, which I think my first real impression of that was the Gore Bush, you know, Florida scandal back in 2000. And people are going to vote their party lines almost exclusively, I think. And I don't think if faced with, do we want to, as Lindsey Graham put it, you know, have our words used against us and have the hypocrisy thrown in our face, or do we want the means to the end, which is, you know, another conservative justice or, you know, a Republican in the White House or whatever it may be. I think at the end of the day, people are always going to go with that ultimate party line conclusion. And I think everything else is just fodder and smoke and mirrors. And it's an interesting debate, but I think it's academic and that's really it. I don't think any real discourse or discussion is going to change people's minds. And, you know, the posturing that their senator may or may not do, I don't think is really going to affect the majority of people's voting. It may be a handful here and there, but I think for the most part, people are going to vote the way they're going to vote before, you know, on Thursday night, basically the same way, or Friday night before the news broke.
It's an interesting point, and I think that it's amplified by the importance of what is about to occur with a new nomination, right? I mean, we have Justice Ginsburg was on the court for 27 years, I think, right? And we have, I mean, this is something that is going to, the effects, the ripple effects of this will last 2-3 decades, right? Plus, I mean, this is a big deal. And if you're saying, Olin, that your feeling is, and I agree with you, by the way, that people are going to vote their party lines regardless of the you know, the day to day, I guess. I think that that's only more true in a case like this, right? Where the effects are so profound of the appointment.
Yeah, absolutely. I think people are going to see the potential. I mean, has Trump not promised that if he appoints another justice or if he gets another term, I don't know what the qualification was, but he'll, you know, overturn Roe v. Wade. And how do you do that? But by voting party lines. If you vote against party lines, then he doesn't get a chance to do that. And there's potentially not a justice in place that will support that if it gets there. So if that's your position, if that's what you're looking to do, then absolutely you're going to look down party lines to make sure it happens. You're not going to look at, like you said, the day-to-day or the minutia of the detail. You're going to use this means as getting to your end.
Well, I think that actually raises the interesting way in which Trump's decision here could potentially affect the election. Because everyone knew that Trump was more or less a pro-life candidate in the last election cycle. But Roe v. Wade is firmly established in law, and there wasn't a lot of reason to believe that if Trump were elected at that time, that he would appoint enough justices to lead to the result of Roe v. Wade being overturned. But now, if he replaces Ginsburg with a pro-life justice, there actually is a real possibility that Roe v. Wade gets overturned. And I know a couple of the names that I've seen bandied about for replacement are Amy Coney Barrett and Barbara Lagoa. And Barrett is openly extremely pro-life and I believe wrote an academic paper on her belief that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided. And Barbara Lagoa, I don't know for sure whether or not she's pro-life, but my understanding is that she's a Catholic mother of seven, which suggests to me that she probably is. And I could see potential voters really taking that into account. And, you know, that's an issue that's strong enough to be a single issue for a lot of voters. And so I don't know. And another thing that just tying this back to what we were discussing earlier, the person that Trump puts forward may affect the likelihood of various Republican senators voting to hold a confirmation vote before the election because they may, you know, receive more or less benefit from confirming that person in their home districts.
Yeah. Let's talk about the ideal candidate for Trump to push forward, because I think the consensus from a lot of people is that it should be a woman again. And you, I'm glad that you brought up these two names that are being floated around, Logan, because besides being a pro-life candidate, I'm looking at Barbara Lagoa, and she is a Latin woman. And I feel like if she is being considered, that would help kind of appeal a lot of these Latino voters that Biden and Trump have just kind of been struggling point by point to win over.
Frankly, I was surprised. And I think the official word from Trump as of yesterday was he will appoint a woman. I think there, it's no longer speculation. It's just who it will be now. I'm surprised by that. Let me rephrase that. I'm not surprised by that. It's surprising that that came so soon because I guess I can't really articulate in as many words why I'm so surprised by that. But I was surprised that that happened within, you know, 48 hours of Justice Ginsburg's passing. I expected that to be a lot more of an open-ended question and at least a variety of names being tossed around. I mean, I think earlier this week, or I guess last week, it was, I think Ted Cruz's name was being tossed around.
I was just about to say that.
So I think, again, I don't really know why I was so surprised by the quick turnaround, but the fact that he's locked in now on it'll be a woman for sure. It seems a little, incongruous with the rest of his actions.
Right. Well, I actually get it, because while it is kind of surprising to just kind of see the what I would interpret as like blatant identity pandering, but I think that the Trump campaign right now is kind of being forced to keep up with the progressive, you know, cliches of Biden's campaign now picking Kamala Harris. And I think that it's also strategic because the gender of the voter shouldn't be something that's so polarizing that candidates should assume that, oh, well, you're going to like it because you're also a woman. I think that's one of the things that really lost Hillary's campaign in 2016. And I think that it's an opportunity for the Republican Party to kind of highlight a female leader who isn't necessarily going to subscribe to the same thoughts that Democrats feel all women should have, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And I mean, there's no question that Justice Ginsburg was a pioneer of the women's rights movement, right? And to me, I mean, not taking away from the gender of these potential nominees, but the issues are just as important, right? And I will admit that I need to go do my due diligence on both of these women that we've brought up here. But my sense is, just like yours, Madeline, is that the issues won't align just because the gender aligns, and that's problematic for me. But I'm not trying to believe or say that you know that matters for most voters, especially for the voters that Trump and the Trump campaign were trying to appease by throwing out those nominees so quickly. And I think that's the reason why they did it. I agree. It was a strategic play. I think it was a smart play. Mm-hmm. But not necessarily one I agree with.
Well, going off of that, then, would you agree that maybe the smartest play would be to hold off nominating and using that almost as the main platform to run on? I think it's no secret. I mean, it is no secret that Trump is trailing in every, you know, justifiable and quantifiable poll so far. And again, I understand 2016, that was the same thing with him and Hillary. But not only is he trailing in polls, but he's he has a poor track record compared to what he was running on in 2016, which was no track record. Right. You know, it's not hard to point out issues with the last 4 years, especially if you're Biden. So wouldn't it be smart for him to use the, hey, if you pick me, I pick the next justice, and that's what you all really want, right? And I think that's understandable and easy to digest for even the most, you know, conflicted GOP voter, because at the end of the day, I'll reiterate what I said earlier, it's a means to an end. And if I think a lot of people who might not be able to stomach a lot of policy will be able to stomach the fact that if I don't vote for Trump, Biden gets to pick potentially. And I really don't want that.
Right.
Yeah. I think to some extent that's a polling question, right? I mean, what's the bump that Trump gets from making the nomination pre-election versus what's the bump for waiting and riding that wave? And I think that's, for if I think of myself as a strategy person on the Trump campaign, that's the question I'm asking. And you know, he's going to get a lot of pressure certainly from the Republican Party, because the Republican Party's position, of course, is going to be, well, if you lose, then we lose that ticket, it gets taken away from us, right? And so it's an interesting thought experiment. I think
it's risky, because I almost think, like, it would make it so much cleaner and, like, harder to argue that it was an unfair process if you wait just 44 more days to let the winner pick the Supreme Court. But I don't think that the Republican Party is confident enough at this very moment. Because as you were saying, Olin, you're right. It's not 2016 with no track record. And it's not even what it could have been in 2018. Like, right now, voters are fresh off of the pandemic, and not a lot of people are convinced that, you know, this administration is the best thing for the economy when it's a moment of, you know, crisis or natural disaster. I don't think they're gonna risk letting Biden win and then pick, even though it would be such a good incentive for voters. I think that the same kind of incentive is gonna be matched with Democratic voters, especially those who healthcare and, you know, reproductive healthcare are their top priorities right now. They're very invigorated. They're gonna try and do everything they can to get more people out on the vote based on these very polarizing issues, which, Logan, as you mentioned, are very likely to affect the outcome of the election.
It wouldn't surprise me if we saw a confirmation vote almost immediately before the election, especially right, given the large quantity of mail-in ballots that are likely to be cast in this election. I think that Trump can probably split the difference in this political calculus and ride a lot of the uncertainty about what's going to happen and refocus the election away from his own policies and foibles and towards the Supreme Court issue, which I think is probably a benefit for him. And also still hold the confirmation and not suffer a whole lot from it, especially given the predictions that I've heard that the mail-in balloting process is likely to favor Democratic candidates. And so the people who are most likely to be voting on Election Day are the people who are most likely to be supporting President Trump already. I guess if I were in his position making a political calculus, that's what I try to do. I try to arrange a vote the day before the election or on Election Day or something like that. Maybe even the day after the election before election results are certified.
Yeah, it just seems like it's more solidified that he could get it in there rather than trying to use it as a trophy for voting him in again a second term.
Yeah, it's a risky thing to use it as a trophy. And my suspicion is that Dan and Olin and you are all right that party policymakers and strategists are going to want to see the confirmation done rather than risk the confirmation on potentially having four more years.
How much do you think the Supreme Court seat is going to be a topic in the upcoming debates? I think I read something saying that the goal from the administration right now is to have a name circulated prior to the first debate.
Yeah, that would be very helpful if they can, you know, make their choice quick enough. But I think with such a limited time window, one thing that I would advise against, you know, just getting somebody out there as quickly as possible so that your voter base can get to know them and support them is that what if in all this rush time, they pick someone that they think is going to be fiercely loyal to them, but then turns out to be a more of an independent thinker like Neil Gorsuch? Like how would one vet loyalty in any amount of time, let alone such a little amount of time?
I don't think it's possible to do. And realistically, I don't think that any president can expect that somebody who they appoint to the Supreme Court, who now all of a sudden has a job for life, is going to show a whole lot of loyalty. And that's really the brilliance of the system, right? Is that the Supreme Court is independent of the presidency and, you know, substantially independent of the Congress. I tend to think that that's a good thing. Although I tend to think that that's something that must particularly frustrate President Trump, because he seems to think that if he does something for someone, then that person owes him loyalty. Loyalty seems to be more important to him than to other presidents, perhaps. I do think for sure we're going to see a name circulated next week. I don't think that Justice Ginsburg will be buried long, more than a day or 48 hours at the most, before Trump releases the name of his favorite replacement candidate. It's certainly not that this is taking the Trump administration by surprise. They've been wise to the fact that Justice Ginsburg is or was elderly and in poor health and suffering from cancer for a long time now. So the potential to replace them or to replace her has been open in their minds for a long time. And I don't think that the timing could have been more advantageous for the president. I think that this vacancy at this moment is the absolute ideal condition for President Trump from a political perspective.
You're right.
I agree as well. And I think I also agree that a name will be circulated before the presidential debate, because at minimum, it is an opportunity, and I I say this with the utmost respect for the Supreme Court, but it's an opportunity to deflect from everything else that is happening in this country right now. Yeah. And it gives, it will take up airtime during the debate.
I think one of the things that it can do is potentially energize some of the 2016 Trump voters who held their nose and voted for Trump because he was the Republican candidate and have only become less enthused about Trump over the past few years, the Lincoln Project sort of Republicans. And those voters may have been likely to stay home in this upcoming election, but for the Supreme Court vacancy. So maybe it helps in that way.
It's a good point.
Although the Lincoln Project has certainly come out strongly against a nomination prior to the election. But I take your point, Logan. I think it's a good one.
Yeah.
Well, then I guess isn't the worst thing to do is rush this? Because let's say, and I know this is improbable, but let's say October 25th, a new justice is appointed. Then what's left for those, you know, party voters or, you know, those borderline in-betweeners who weren't sure if they were going to vote or how they were going to vote mm-hmm. to vote at all. If, like we said, the main issue is essentially resolved before the election, wouldn't that be disadvantageous?
You know, I don't think so. I almost think that
they would go out to reward Trump saying you did this thing good.
Yeah, I think so. I do. But either way, I mean, realistically, if he gets the nomination secured or if he gets the appointment secured, shall I say, I mean, even if he loses the election, what grounds is Biden going to have for saying, oh, just kidding, I don't like that now, so I'm going to remove your pick? Can't happen. Am I right?
Yeah, none, right?
Well, no, he wouldn't. But if we're all agreeing, it sounds like that this is the potentially the biggest issue in front of voters on November 2nd, then removing it, I feel like, would hurt Trump. I disagree. I don't think too many, you know, unhappy Trump or borderline Republicans are going to say, great job, Don, I guess you got my vote now. I think they're going to say, all right, well, I'm happy with that, but I'm still not voting, or I'm voting against you, or whatever they were going to do originally.
I think to Logan's point earlier, that's one reason to hype this up and maybe hold a vote on election day or the night before or the day after, right? And I think you have a good point because, you know, if I'm a quote unquote silent Republican that is otherwise really on the fence, but I really care about a right-leaning or right-wing Supreme Court justice being appointed, and that's given to me a couple weeks before the election, I may not go to the ballots. I think that's probably right. I mean, some might. I don't think he gains a lot to his base by doing that, I think is probably where I come out on it.
I also think that we need to remember that whether there's a vote on confirmation is not the president's decision. And this is, I think, a situation where his own personal election issue interests may be at issue with the party's interests, and especially the interests of some senators who expect to outlast President Trump, regardless of whether or not he wins re-election. So I take your point, Olin, that maybe it's to the president's advantage for this to continue to be an open election issue. But I think that that's very much going to be in contest with the interests of the party overall, which would be to lock this in and avoid any risk that that Biden makes the appointment, especially because I think if Trump loses the election, there's significantly reduced chance that he's able to push through a nominee in the lame duck period. I think that the backlash that some senators would face from that, it would probably be enough to cause them to shy away from doing it. Because it's one thing to have the hypocrisy of their 2018, or their rather their what was 2016 positions saying, oh, well, we shouldn't appoint Merrick Garland or vote on Merrick Garland because it's only 10 months until an election with voting now. But the hypocrisy is almost overwhelming if we hold an election and Trump doesn't win, and then they go ahead and appoint during the lame duck period. I think there would be backlash over that. As I said earlier, I think that loyalty will disappear in the lame duck period. And I think that whatever candidate President Trump ends up putting forward is going to be controversial and probably not the ideal candidate from the perspective of a number of Republican senators. And I think they're less likely to vote to confirm a candidate that they're maybe not thrilled with if President Trump is on his way out.